Hey everyone, it's Hamish from the Young Investors Podcast. Myself and Brandon are excited to bring you your weekly rundown of the latest business and investing news from around the world. A quick reminder before we get started, any advice provided by Brandon is general and does not consider your financial situation, needs, or objectives, so consider whether it's appropriate for you. Brandon van der Kolk is authorized to provide general financial product advice in Australia and is authorized representative number 1305795 of Guideway Financial Services Proprietary Limited, AFSL number 420367. Please see the description box for Brandon's financial services guide. Past performance is not a reliable indication of future investment returns. But with that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Young Investors Podcast. Hamish Hodder.
Hello, hello, hello.
Joins me as always. What's going on, mate?
Oh, not a lot. You know what I realized? I haven't, so when we went to the States, we both brought back we were both gifted very nicely by our friend in Omaha. Two of these, actually, I'm not sure if you can see this on the podcast, but the bobbleheads, yeah, go and grab them. The Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett bobbleheads, which are on my YouTube kind of studio set, but I think it might be cropped out, so you might not be able to see it. Yes, Brandon's got props.
Here they are. Except, I tell you what, one of the glasses broke in my bag.
Well, that's what I wanted to say. My Charlie Munger one, the base broke flight. So I need to get around to I think I'll be able to glue it though. The glasses might be kind of tricky.
I think you can glue it. I mean, they just sit on the face. So I think I could glue it.
Yeah.
I just need to actually get around to doing it.
But yeah. Yeah,
Charlie Munger is without his vision at the moment.
Yeah, well, I've just got
Buffett. So good though.
So yeah, I've only got Buffett on my desk, so I need to get the Charlie Munger one fixed.
Yeah, damn. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was such a good gift. A good gift.
So nice. Yeah.
Very unexpected. But yeah, how you been doing, mate?
Yeah, going well. I'll be coming up to Canberra shortly, yes. Which is exciting.
You will be.
Haven't seen the studio in person and haven't met any of the guys. So yeah, I was trying to think like when was the last time I came up to Canberra? Because I haven't come up to record a podcast or anything with you, but I think the last time I went probably was must have been 2020 or something like that. So it's a long time ago.
Music festival or something.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to remember. I think Spilt Milk. Yeah, I think
Groove in the Moo, one of those.
Yeah, maybe both of them. I've come up a couple of times to Canberra, but not in the last few years.
It'll be good to have you in the office. We'll do a live podcast from right over there on my standard YouTube set, which will be really cool.
That'll be sick.
I'm looking forward to it. It'll be good to we've even got one empty desk over here, so it'll be good to have you in.
Fantastic.
We got the full setup for you, mate.
Yeah.
You don't even have to bring your laptop if you don't want.
Is this how you start baiting me to hire me? Don't worry about your channel. You know, come work on our channel.
What's that, Hamish? Your views are down? No, they're definitely not down.
What's that? You guys make how much? wow.
It'll be cool to hang out. It'll be cool to hang out. All right, mate, what are we talking about today?
Yeah, we've got a few...
big ones.
We do. We have the conclusion, one conclusion of the big SBF FTX fraud trial. The jury is in, so we'll talk about that and everything that was kind of involved in the last couple of days of the trial and what the jury ultimately decided, which I'm sure everyone knows, but we can talk about some of the details. We got an RBA, central bank rate decision here in Australia, which we'll talk about. We've got a bunch of earnings. We've got Warner Brothers, Disney, Paramount, Apple. What else have we got? WeWork.
WeWork.
Went
kaboom.
They finally are done officially. So.
Yep. Officially.
Yeah. Correct.
All right, let's do it, eh? Yeah.
So with that said, today's episode is brought to you by Seeking Alpha, your one-stop shop for stock analysis, market data, and news. Access expert analysis and news for thousands of stocks. View buy, hold, and sell ratings from members, Wall Street analysts, and Seeking Alpha's own algorithm. Screen for stocks using a variety of fundamental and technical analysis metrics. Access 10 years of financial data and company filings. And manage your portfolio by tracking your investments with price alerts so you never miss a buying opportunity again. Click the link in the episode description or head directly to seekingalpha.me/younginvestors to try Seeking Alpha free for 7 days and get a $50 off coupon if it's your first time signing up to an annual subscription. Where
very good.
Should we?
We got to start with Sam. Sam Bankman Fraud. We have to start with him.
it's too perfect, isn't it? Sam Bankman.
It's
Fraud.
So perfect.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite things about media coverage of big events is there's always so many play on words.
Alliteration
in titles. Like there's clever stuff that they come up with, and Sam Bankman Fraud is just. It's just too good.
the whole even just his last name, just full stop, like just that his last name is Bankman.
Yeah, he's a banking fraud and his name is Bankman Fraud.
Well, even Freed can be read as fried, so it's like Bankman Fried.
Yeah. It's too good. Anyway. But anyway, so FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried was convicted Thursday of stealing billions of dollars from customers from the doomed crypto exchange FTX in what prosecutors called one of the biggest financial frauds in U.S. history. So we got we got the conclusion of it. And I thought just before we kind of go through the actual conclusion, the jury deliberations and that sort of thing, the last couple of days were really interesting on the trial because as I think one of us mentioned it, but we weren't sure whether SBF was going to actually testify on his own behalf. Sometimes defendants do, sometimes they don't. Usually they don't in these kinds of cases because it's a last chance for the prosecution to kind of cross-examine and really make you look bad right before the jury goes and deliberates. But he ultimately... decided that on the last couple of days he would testify and give his own testimony. So of course, first his legal team asked him questions, and he confidently told jurors that he was a well-meaning player in the wild west of crypto, and that he frequently met with lawmakers in Washington in hopes of building a regulatory framework for the industry. What a guy. He said he never defrauded customers. He said he never defrauded customers.
What an absolute legend.
Yeah, look, find that man innocent. He said he never defrauded customers, but regretted not instituting better risk management at FTX before its collapse on November 2022, which is one way of putting it. Should have done better risk management to make $10 billion not go oops.
It wasn't fraud. It was a failure of risk management.
Yeah, exactly.
Obviously.
Yeah. It was a big old oopsie.
Whoopsie doopsie. We've made that joke a couple of times, haven't we? Yeah. Oopsie.
I can't remember where I heard the first person say that, but I remember bursting out laughing when I heard that. Like, oops.
I think that was PewDiePie, wasn't it? That was his thing.
oh, yeah. I meant around.
Did that for a while.
I meant around this specifically. I heard someone say, refer to his defense as oops, which is so good.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that was kind of what his legal team kind of put forward. And then, of course, he gets to be cross-examined by the prosecutor, and he absolutely crumbled. All the prosecutor had to do was contrast his public and private statements to show how many times he lied. So things like there's just a bunch of tweets where he's saying that FTX is fine while he's messaging the team basically saying things are not fine. So there's just a lot of physical evidence in this case that fraud was committed. In the cross-examination, FBF said, "I do not recall." He said that 140 times when being asked about messages and tweets that he himself had written less than, 18 months ago.
That's so...
Which is dear, exactly dear. Why...
I do not recall.
It's exactly why usually you don't want to... go on the stand in these situations unless there's no other choice and it's just a desperate Hail Mary, which it kind of was in this case. But it's just so easy for the prosecution to ask questions that he can't answer without admitting to fraud. He has to say, I don't recall.
Incriminating himself.
And even though I don't recall isn't necessarily incriminating, it sounds incriminating when you're holding up messages and tweets that you wrote less than a year ago. Every single time it's, I don't remember writing this tweet.
It's pretty hectic. I'm just waiting for someone to make the meme to superimpose his face on the Wolf of Wall Street scene where they get the scene? Stratton Oakmont people in with the SEC and they the prosecutors then they get all the directors down. I do not recall. I do not recall that either.
I do not recall.
Yeah. He's like, yes. No, I don't remember that at all.
Yeah. He's like eating a donut or something. He's like, no.
No, nothing. It's like, it's so strange that the people here, no one seems to remember anything about the Steve Madden IPO. Yeah. It's like, I don't know. I can't recall.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It's very anyway. Funny. So, yeah, it was basically like that. Assistant U.S. Attorney Nicholas Ruse told the court in closing arguments Wednesday that there was no serious dispute that $10 billion in customer money was sitting in FTX crypto exchange went missing. So, again, there was no dispute over that. There was plenty of evidence that the money was missing. The issue is whether Bankman-Fried knew that what taking the money was wrong, which is the crux of every fraud trial. It's the most difficult thing to prove, which is intent. There has to be intent to steal money. It's not, which, you know, sounds like a crazy thing, right? But they're two different things. One, to accidentally or basically to accidentally lose money or to intentionally steal it. It seems crazy when we're talking about billions of dollars in customer funds. You would, but that is obviously the crux of the case. That was the closing statements. The jury was sent away at 3:15. They deliberated for a little while. They had a dinner break at 6 p.m. and at 7:37 they'd reached a verdict, which is incredibly fast. And whenever a jury comes back that fast, it is very bad for the defense in almost every case. It is almost always a situation where there's just immediately a unanimous decision to convict. So it's very bad. Just to put this in perspective, Elizabeth Holmes trial, we covered that a little while ago, the Theranos fraud. Deliberations lasted 7 whole days over the span of 2 weeks. So, you know, that was 7 days. In this case, it was 3 hours and a steak dinner. Very, very fast.
It could have been sooner, but they knew that if they didn't prolong it a little bit, they wouldn't get their free dinner.
Probably.
They're like, 3:50. Guys, we've already got our decision and it's only 3:55, but I don't know. Steak on tonight.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't want to go home and cook.
Yeah. Oh, we may as well stick around till like 7. All right. And you can still catch some TV when you get home.
Yeah, crazy. So
yeah, it's very quick. So fast. It's unreal how fast that was.
Yeah, because
they could have just gone around the room. What do you reckon? Guilty? Yeah. Yeah, probably. Yep, sounds like it. All right, done.
Well, pretty much, because usually what will happen, there's no like set rules for how they have to do it, but usually they'll make a quick vote immediately just to fill out the room. So if the first vote that they did the moment they went into the room was everyone said he was guilty, then there might not have been all that much to discuss. And I think clearly there wasn't. So they found him guilty. They came back, found him guilty of all 7 charges, 2 counts of wire fraud, 2 counts of conspiracy to commit wire fraud, 1 count of securities fraud, 1 count of conspiracy to commit commodities fraud, and 1 count of conspiracy to commit money laundering, which in total carry a maximum sentence of 115 years.
Ouchiwawa.
Yeah. So, he's facing potentially 115 years in prison. Will he serve 115 years? Probably not. I would say it's fairly unlikely that he gets the maximum sentence. Particularly in non-violent crimes, it's pretty common for sentences to be served concurrently rather than consecutively. So rather than serving a 10-year sentence and then a 10-year sentence after, you can serve, often they'll be served at the same time. So in other words, you just serve 10 years for 2 charges. So he might get far less than 115 years, but really we have no idea. It could be anywhere between a few years to the maximum sentence. Just to give you maybe a couple of examples that I could find on like kind of 2 ends of the spectrum. Elizabeth Holmes, which again, we spoke about Theranos, she was charged with 12 counts of fraud, but only convicted on 4 counts. So, you know, three less counts than Sam is up for. Her maximum sentence could have been 20 years and she ended up getting 11 and that was actually knocked down to 9 a little bit later. So she got about half of the maximum sentence.
Right.
So just to keep that in mind. At the other end of the spectrum, you have Bernie Madoff, the biggest Ponzi scheme in history, the biggest fraud charges in history. He actually pled guilty to 11 charges. So there was 11 charges of securities fraud, wire fraud, mail fraud, money laundering, making false statements, perjury, and theft from an employee benefit plan. And he was sentenced to 150 years.
Right.
So those are kind of, you know, the two ends of where this can go. Obviously, Bernie Madoff this case is pretty crazy too, but that is a once in a lifetime case. So it made sense that he got such a crazy sentence. But all we really know about SBF is that in terms of the number of charges and the dollar amount of fraud committed, he's in the middle of those two. So that you would expect that the result will be
though.
Somewhere in there.
Who knows? We'll see.
yeah, exactly. Sentencing is March of 2024. So we won't get an update around that for quite a little while.
So what happens in between now and then? Does he go to jail now, or he just goes around living his normal life?
Yeah, he figures out a way to hide. No. He's out on bail. So he made bail. His bail was, I think the bail was set at 200, or the bond was set at 200 million or something insane like that.
Right.
So he was able to pay, I think they have to pay 10% of the bond or something like that. So he had to pay $20 million to be out on bail and not sit in prison until the sentencing.
I don't really understand the system very, very well, but it's such an interesting system how you can be like found guilty and then just be like, all right, guys, I'll see you in March. Yeah. All right. Meet back here in March. All right, guys. See ya.
Yeah. Yeah.
Back on your merry way.
Yeah.
It's so interesting.
It is odd. You would think from the, I'm pretty sure he would still be out. I'm not actually entirely sure. Maybe he's not, but, I would guess that he would be until sentencing, and then he would have to report. That's at least the way it went with Elizabeth Holmes.
It's even just funny, just like the whole concept of bail. Like, we think you've done something really wrong, and you're going to pay the price, but if you give us some money, we'll let you go. It's strange.
It doesn't really work for like people like SBF. He's pretty well connected.
When money's no issue.
Like, it doesn't really matter what they set that bond at. He was not going to be sitting in a prison cell. Other people might not be able to afford, like, a $20,000 bond for a crime that maybe they didn't even commit, and they just have to sit there for a while and then deal with it later. So, yeah, it's a pretty busted system. But you know what I thought? We have a guess about what his sentence will be, and I'll scrape through this in March of 2024, and we'll see how close we were.
Okay.
Yeah, you have a guess first, because I've written down what
my guess is 28 years.
Wait, actually, did you look at what I said?
I just copied what you had written down, because I've got no idea.
Yeah, I thought for a second we were just on the same wavelength. I thought we were on the...
I just saw what you jotted down in the...
No, I have no idea either. Complete guess. My guess is 28 years. Okay.
Well, I don't know. He's not very good with words, so I feel like when it'll... I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Let's go... I don't think it'll be... What is it? 115? I don't think it'll be that. I don't think he's getting out on his 140th birthday or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Well,
so here's my logic. So he's 30, right? So anything more than like a 50 or...
He's 30, okay.
So any... I think he's 30, right? Or 31 or something like that. So anything more than...
I don't know.
Anything more than a 50 or a 60-year sentence is the equivalent of the max, right?
Right.
So I think, you know, the judge is considering, will consider a number of things, right? Like, have they committed the crime before? Are they remorseful? Is there a chance of rehabilitation or a risk of reoffending? So, you know, either he gets 60 or more years, and it's a life sentence, basically, or he gets something where he can come out in his 50s or 60s and rehabilitate, I guess, is kind of the argument. So that's my logic.
I have no idea, but I think you're right with the whole idea of like how it was non-violent, like it's white collar crime kind of stuff, maybe plays into it a bit as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. These ultra wealthy folks generally tend to find some way to wiggle their way out a few years early, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah. True.
So I don't know. Maybe let's say 15 years.
15. Okay.
Yeah. 1-5.
All right. Cool. All right.
Well, he's going to knock 100 years off his sentence or whatever, whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah. That,
yeah. What? Yeah. We'll see.
So there you go.
I'll write it down. Brandon, 15 years.
Beautiful.
All right.
All right.
We'll watch this space. We'll revisit.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see.
We'll revisit. All right. Do you want to talk about another interesting story of negative story? I don't know where I was going with that. We work. Hooray. Segway of the year, everyone. Yeah. Segway of the year.
I was like, wait, what don't I know about WeWork?
Thank you, fans. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. No, I can't remember. Wasn't there some controversy with that? What's his name? Adam Newman guy?
I can't remember. I looked at this a long time ago. Yeah. And I remember he had some...
covered this ages ago.
Yeah, he had some really strange, like, workplace habits. Like, I think he was a big partier and, I don't know, he wouldn't be working all that much or something like that. I don't know. There was a bunch of weird stuff that I remember. I saw a documentary or something a little while ago. But I haven't been keeping up with it recently, so I'm not too sure.
No, it doesn't look like he did anything too crazy. Okay. Well, guess what, Hamish? WeWork is bankrupt. All right. What have you got next? No. WeWork, the shared office firm that was once valued at $47 billion, has now been forced to file for bankruptcy in the US.
Wow.
The decision follows the meteoric rise and fall of a company which was once seen as the future of the workplace. WeWork reported total debts of $18.65 billion against total assets of $15.06 billion in an initial filing. Valued in 2019 at $47 billion in a round led by SoftBank, the company first tried and failed to go public 5 years ago.
Yeah.
The bankruptcy will affect the company's business in the US and Canada. The firm said its co-working spaces will remain open and operational, including in the UK. In an email to tenants in London seen by BBC, the firm said it remained fully committed to providing its services and planned to remain in the vast majority of our buildings. Yeah, interesting.
Right.
So, I don't know. We'll see. Are you going to try and smooth things out?
So, is WeWork's whole business is co-working spaces, right? So, these places
I think
where-
so, yeah.
How does that even work? So you just rent like a desk or?
Yeah. Like so WeWork, I think WeWork either buys or leases the building,
right?
Kits it out as a co-working space and then tries to make money over the top of their costs by charging people a membership fee to be able, or people or businesses a membership fee to use their space. So for example, in the WeWork office in the middle of Sydney, I know some just individuals like you and me that subscribe to go and be able to use WeWork's facilities there and work there. Mm. But they also like offer space for small businesses. So small businesses can rent out
square footage to
and they have like a pretty well kitted out office already to go.
Mm.
And you know, that WeWork obviously has all the amenities. They've got the kitchen and the bar and, you know, taught, like all that sort of stuff that comes along with it. It's kind of, WeWork already figures it out. So that's kind of their business model. Sorry, yeah?
I was going to say, you would think in the internet age that is something that's quite desirable. Given you do have all of these kind of small teams and even just individual kind of gig economy workers, that are kind of all popping up because of the rise of the internet and social media. So you would think the idea, maybe the way they went about it just isn't, you know, wasn't viable or they were too aggressive or whatever. I don't know if you've got some information on that or anything, but you would think like the core idea is something that will continue to be valuable as like a space to work for people.
Mm. Yeah. It says here, as recently as September, the company said it had been actively renegotiating leases and that it was here to stay. WeWork WeWork had close to $16 billion in long-term lease obligations, according to the securities filings. So there you go.
Right.
What else did it say here? The COVID pandemic caused further pain. Yep, as companies abruptly ended their leases and the economic slump that followed led even more clients to close their doors. It was disclosed in an August regulatory filing that bankruptcy could be a concern. Yeah, that's right. WeWork debuted through a special purpose acquisition company in 2021, but since lost 98% of its value, everybody. Congratulations.
Hang on a second. I think that's the most successful SPAC. I think that's pretty good. that's not bad. That's not bad at all.
The quick wit. I love it.
No, that's crazy.
Get this. It's not a good sign when your company announces a reverse stock split. The company in mid-August announced a 1-for-40 reverse stock split to get its shares trading back above $1, which is a requirement for keeping its New York Stock Exchange listing.
Yeah, not good. Not good. Yeah.
WeWork shares had fallen to a low of around 10 cents and were trading at about 83 cents before the stock was halted on Monday. Based on its last share price, WeWork is now worth less than $50 million. So it debuted... No, sorry. This is in a funding round led by SoftBank. In 2019, it was valued at $47 billion. And now it's valued at less than $50 million.
Yeah, so, it's one of there are some really good like mini doc like video essays and mini docs on YouTube about what happened to WeWork, because it is one of the most egregious examples of overvalued unprofitable tech startups. Well, this was 2019, but you know, we certainly saw a fair share
same story
2021. But there was tons of them in 2019 as well, just before COVID. It was COVID like pushed it all back a little bit. But 2019, it was already, a lot of these companies were already bubbling up because of rock bottom interest rates. So, yeah, insane story. Crazy.
So there you go, WeWork. See you later. The company leases millions of square feet of office space in 777 locations around the world. So it's everywhere. There you go.
Wow.
777 locations. But yep. Sorry, mate. Bad luck. You run out of money.
Yep.
Yeah, I guess we'll see what happens, because they seem committed to staying open.
Right. Yeah.
They seem committed to keeping the doors open to their thing. So I guess they'll, I don't know, try and find some new owners, or who knows.
Yeah. Well, certainly. That's generally kind of the way it goes. Hopefully, you know, maybe split some assets up here and there and... Yeah, find someone who'll come in and potentially fund the business for a little while and maybe make it work by running it a different way or structuring it a different way.
Yeah, we shall see. But for now, WeWork, it's not looking good. Sorry if you're an investor in WeWork.
98% is not great.
That's all I have to say. Hey?
98%. Not a great rate of return.
Could be better.
Yeah, could be better.
Could be better.
Yeah.
Could be better.
Yeah.
Hey, do you want to talk about Apple, or do you want to talk about the world of the big media companies? What's your feeling?
Let's start with Apple. Yeah, take us through Apple.
You want to start with Apple?
Yeah, take us through Apple.
Apple's always an interesting one.
Mm.
We know it's Warren Buffett's largest holding. Holds a massive, massive chunk. It's like half of his portfolio now.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, half of his stock portfolio, of course. Berkshire has a lot of wholly owned businesses too. This is definitely one that Warren Buffett tunes into.
Yeah.
Actually, before we get started, did you see the recent Apple announcement?
Which one?
The MacBook?
No.
No?
No.
No, I think it was around Halloween. They announced new MacBook Pro with their new M3 chips.
Mm-hmm.
But they kept making all these comparisons, not to the M2 chip.
Hmm.
They were making the comparisons back to the M1 chips to try and make the... You know how they're always... They always want to say like, and now with 50 billion times the performance. You know how Apple's always like... And then they'll just put an asterisk and then just move on.
So that's
15 million times the brightness. So they do. So they've been comparing all these stats for the M3, these new M3 chips, and they've been comparing it to the M1. And then they just show that compared to the M2, it's only like... So versus M1, it's like 50% better, 70% better, blah, blah, blah. And then compared to M2, it's like 10% better.
Yeah, classic. Like
15% better. So you know what they did? Because their hardware couldn't impress this time around. And Marquez was, I think, ripping them apart because just the hardware bumps aren't really that. He was basically just saying don't upgrade because it's not worth it.
Yeah.
But of course, Apple has another trick up the sleeve. Mm. Okay, we're not going to get people to buy because of these new chips. What can we do? We're going to offer a new color. So now you can get a nice matte black Apple laptop.
Oh.
Official MacBook in black.
Sold. Take my money.
Sold. I tell you who is sold. Claude is sold.
Is he?
He's loving it.
Mm?
He doesn't care about the specs. He wants it because it's black.
Yeah. Yeah, that would look nice.
He literally came over to me the other day and it was like, you know what? I think it's time for us to upgrade all of our MacBooks in the office. I was like, dude. I was like, why? He's like, because it's black. Look at it.
Yeah, I think you should do that. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, classic Apple. So
Classic Apple. But yeah, moving on to their earnings, we'll start with their income statement. So revenue for Q3 was down slightly year over year. So from 90.1 billion to 89.5 billion. Of that revenue, 67.2 billion came from hardware, and then 22.3 billion came from services. So aka 75% of their revenue came from hardware and 25% came from services.
Right.
Last year, 79% came from hardware and only 21% came from services. So that tells you the story of what's been going on. Their services business keeps bumping up and up and up, and their hardware business is either staying flat or coming down. I'll talk about that a little bit in a minute. So on top of that slight reduction in revenue, cost of sales also reduced from 52 billion to 49 billion. So overall gross profit improved by 6%. So operating expenses were flat and operating income grew 8% year over year. So that's a good sign. Net income grew 10.7%, but diluted earnings per share, Hamish Hodder, grew by 13%.
Wow. There you go. Hmm.
Why might that be?
Yeah.
Well, it's because they reduced their diluted shares outstanding from 16.1 billion to 15.7 billion.
Yep.
So there you go. Continued share buybacks.
Yep. They're a cash machine.
Now, they are a cash machine. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. But overall, from there, I also like to look at, they also give a breakdown of what their revenue breakdown of where the revenue is being generated from their hardware and their services. So interestingly, iPhone only grew very slightly, 42.6 billion to 43.8 billion. But apart from that, it's the hardware's struggling a bit. Mac went from 11.5 billion down to 7.6 billion in sales year over year. iPad went from 7.2 billion down to 6.4. And even just wearables, accessories, that group went from 9.65 billion down to 9.32 billion. So,
ouch.
iPhone jumped a little bit. Tim Cook said he was happy with iPhone sales, but the rest kind of faltered a little.
Yeah, is this a quarter or is this annual?
A quarter.
So they did 45 billion in iPhone sales in a quarter. That's crazy.
Yep.
How's that even possible? Like, I don't know. That's crazy to me because I would imagine a lot of people don't need to upgrade their phones every year anymore. Mm. I certainly don't upgrade my phone every single year, but that's just, it's just mind blowing. Is that like that figure?
Yeah.
I know they've been doing that for a while. Like it's not a new thing or anything, but
do you want to know the 12-month figure?
Yeah.
The 12-month figure, but well, you can kind of guess obviously it's like four times. No, but the 12-month figure ended September 30th, 2023 for iPhone. They sold $200 billion worth.
Yeah, that's of insane. iPhones. That's crazy. Yeah, they must have a crazy Q4. I guess like Christmas, people kind of load up.
Why you have to compare like quarter to quarter, like not quarter by quarter. You have to compare year over year.
Yeah,
when we're looking at the quarters,
it is just mind blowing to me that's the level of sales that they're doing annually, on a product that doesn't really get all that much better every year. But obviously they have their base that buy the phone every year, and then I guess most people buy a new phone every 2 years usually or 3 years. People are kind of on those plans. So, but yeah, it's astounding. It's astounding.
Yep, the iPhone crowd, they want the latest iPhone, but yeah, it is pretty hectic. So iPhone up a little bit, Mac down, iPad down, wearables and accessories down, And then services went from 19.2 billion to 22.3 billion year over year. So pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So that was kind of their income statement data. And then if we move along to balance sheet stuff, their cash and marketable securities came in at $61.5 billion. So a pretty nice buffer. But Apple's interesting because they don't, I feel like they should have one of these just like stellar balance sheets, but they don't, you know, like the Google and the Meta, and we look at those balance sheets, we're like, oh my God, they're unstoppable. And yes, I'd make the argument that Apple's also unstoppable, but it's interesting they just structure their balance sheet a little bit differently. So for example, like for Apple, current assets are $143.6 billion and current liabilities are $145.3 billion. So
right.
They've actually got more in current liabilities than they do current assets. Like their total debt is $111 billion. They do have a fair chunk of debt. So it's interesting to see them structuring their balance sheet a little bit differently. And I mean, they're different businesses. Obviously, Apple has to create products and sell products, and that takes more capital than Facebook or Google, which are predominantly software-based companies. But it's just interesting seeing the difference in structure. But I did want to say, obviously, we talk about like current ratios and stuff, and with current assets lower than current liabilities, you might be like, oh gosh, like are they in trouble? It's important to know that no, they're not in trouble because they could always stop dumping their earnings into share repurchases and just put it towards their balance sheet if they so desired. But yeah, it's interesting to see that they run that kind of balance sheet. For an example, I looked at their cash flow statement. Apple had $110 billion in operating cash flow for the quarter. They decided to spend $77.5 billion of that on share repurchases and then another $15 billion in dividends.
Yep.
So,
yeah.
They could add it to the cash pile. They could manipulate their balance sheet if they wanted, but they're just choosing to, I don't know, give Tim Cook a bigger bonus by the earnings per share figure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really is the story of the difference between Apple and Google and Meta. Is Google and Meta, don't get me wrong, like they do their fair share of share repurchases, but Apple is much more in that kind of mature part of their stage of business where they're distributing most of their earnings rather than stacking in order to grow.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean they won't grow. They clearly are still able to find ways to expand their business through services and that sort of thing, but yeah, they look, their balance sheet looks much, it looks kind of, it's more on the side of something like Coca-Cola, not as far as Coca-Cola, but more on the side of Coca-Cola where they start taking on debts and doing a lot of distribution, and look for ways to kind of, increase the efficiency of how money is used on their balance sheet rather than, and less focus on growth. Or at least they're kind of trending that way. And of course Tim Cook gets his, he gets to increase earnings per share, and then he makes $100 million a year, whatever the hell he made last year.
Woo! Yeah, he did. Yeah. His compensation is hectic. He had a massive compensation plan that was supposed to go for like 10 years, and it finished like 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And then, so he had this one plan for 10 years, and then he essentially just in the last 2 years has had his own share compensation plans each year. It's like he had one for 10 years and then like a couple of years ago he had another one just for that year, and now he's got another one for this year and he'll have another one next year. And yeah, the one that was signed last year I think is worth like $99 million.
It's just ridiculous. Yeah
crazy. It's hectic.
Crazy.
It's so hectic.
Yeah
crazy world of executive compensation.
Yep pretty much.
All right, Hamish. Yeah, we'll get there one day.
Yeah, $100 million a year, you reckon?
We can dream.
We can dream. Not if we become the CEO of some of these companies. Let's talk about. No, I'm kidding. let's talk about media, because we had a bunch of media companies report all in the same week. So I thought we'd kind of combine them all together rather than spending a bunch of time on each. We'll kind of just spend a couple of minutes on each of them and compare and contrast, kind of like how we do with Google and Facebook, or Alphabet and Meta, I should say. We'll start with the big one. We'll start with Disney. Disney actually reported their full year earnings. They're one of those stupid companies that decide to report on a different cycle than everybody else.
So stupid.
Yeah. For some reason, they report their fourth quarter In the third quarter. It's very clearly the third quarter. Woo. It's been the third quarter. It's always been the third quarter.
I wonder what Zoom's up to right now. I wonder where they're up to. What are they reporting?
Yeah, Zoom
think
was
they're
like
reporting Q9 of 2032.
Yeah, yeah. They're time travelers. They're always like 18 months in the future.
They run on a 13 quarter year.
Yeah.
So figure that out.
Yeah.
What? Does that make sense?
Yeah, exactly. They work four times as hard. They just they have four years in one. Speeding along. No, so yeah, so we got Disney full year results. They reported $88.9 billion of revenue for the full year. Which is obviously an enormous amount of revenue, up 7% year over year. In terms of where that came from, 13%, they had a 13% increase in their experiences business. So parks, their cruise lines, their hotels, that kind of thing, had a 13% increase. So that business continues to do very, very well. There was a negative 9% growth on their linear networks. So they're kind of cable channels and that sort of thing. They had a 12% increase in revenue for direct to consumer. And then they had negative 3% growth from content sales and licensing to third parties. So like some of the content that Disney makes and then sells to Netflix or whoever it is.
Right.
So yeah, you can see kind of parks business going very well, linear business continuing to decline, direct to consumer continuing to grow, which is good. And then content sales is relatively flat. In terms of what's kind of going on specifically with some of these segments. So linear continues to decline at a pretty fast rate. There's really two main causes why linear is going down. One is the affiliate revenue continued to decline because of a decline in subscribers. So less cable subscribers means cable companies give less fees to Disney for hosting their networks. And then lower advertising revenue due to lower average viewership. So they kind of get hit by kind of both directions, unfortunately. They get lower affiliate fees and lower revenues. So that's just continued to be a story for those businesses. People are cutting the cords. I think in terms of pay TV overall in the US, pay TV users has gone from about 110 million households to about 65 million today. So it's retracted a lot. Although it's still pretty big. If you really like 65 million pay TV households is kind of that's a lot of households still actually subscribed, which is surprising to me at least.
Considering what they got 330 million people total.
Yeah.
Not even households.
Yeah.
So I wonder how many households there are in the US. I actually don't know.
I think it's about 120 or 140 million. It was either 120 or 140 or something.
131.2 million households.
There you go. Split down the middle. So it's still one in two households still have cable. So
interesting.
Yeah, there you go. But it has been going down at a pretty fast rate, about 5 million households a year. So you run that out into the future for a few years and it's not looking too good. So that's a linear business, of course. Everyone knew that's kind of been in decline. Then there's direct-to-consumer, which Disney has been one of the leaders in streaming. They've done an incredible job at building out their different platforms. Quarter over quarter, they added 4.5 million subscribers across their apps, so they continue to grow. They actually added 7 million subscribers on Disney+, but they lost 3 million subscribers for Disney+ Hotstar, which is their Indian-specific Disney+ platform. So in terms of their actual core Disney Plus platform, which has quite a high average revenue per user, they added quite a few subscribers. Hulu and domestic Disney Plus were both flat. So there was kind of no growth there. Operating profit came in at, for the whole company, came in at $12.9 billion, which was up 6% year over year. They beat expectations based on their cost-cutting efforts that they've been doing throughout the year. I think they cut their cost by like $2 billion or something like that. And of course, there's been kind of reduced content spend through this year because of the writers and actors strikes kind of preventing a lot of production.
Interesting. Yeah.
So that's Disney.
Right. Sorry, yeah. I think we've got some terrible lag at the moment, Hamish.
Yeah, it's okay.
I think we're battling with the lag. Have you been noticing as well?
Yeah. That's okay though. I'll just keep going through. Yeah. So that's Disney. That was the first and the biggest of the media companies. Next, we have Warner Brothers Discovery, which reported Q3. So thank you, Warner Brothers, for actually correctly identifying that we're in the third quarter. So they reported revenue of $10 billion, which was up 2% year over year. So pretty much not really any growth out of their business overall. It's a very similar story to Disney. So you had, they produced $3.2 billion of revenue from their studio segment, which was up 4% year over year. So that's their theatrical release business. They released Barbie, which was obviously a massive success. And that contributed to the 4% increase in revenue from studios. They had $4.8 billion in revenue from their network segment, which was down 7% year over year. They had a minus 2% on affiliate revenue and a minus 18% on advertising revenue. Direct-to-consumer was $2.4 billion, up 5% year over year. They actually lost 700,000 subscribers in Q3. And have a total of 95.1 million. So they actually lost subscribers. And I just checked, they haven't gained any subscribers in the last 12 months, which is kind of crazy. It's one thing, I think all the streamers, all the media companies have had, you know, one, two quarters of tough quarters where they've lost subscribers. But even Netflix didn't lose subscribers for a 12-month period. And quite interesting to kind of observe that. They had a net loss of $417 million across the whole company. They reported adjusted EBITDA, which was positive $3 billion. So they made money, isn't it? The actual income statement says a $500 million loss, but they've come up with their own figure, which I trust 100%. That says they made $3 billion. So,
You know, the crazy thing about this, I didn't actually realize this, but new money makes more in adjusted EBITDA than Warner Brothers Discovery. How crazy is that?
Wow.
Our adjusted EBITDA is $10 billion.
Wow. That's pretty impressive. That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well done. Well done.
Yeah, it took a lot of adjusting, but... adjusting it for a long time.
I'm sure they were too.
Adding a lot of zeros.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they were too. The reason I joke about this is because it's just kind of silly because they're also using this specific adjusted figure to say that their streaming business is profitable when on a net income basis, it is not profitable and it has never been profitable. They're just, if they remove, interest, which they have $45 billion in debt, so we'll just remove the interest on that debt file. don't look at that too closely. Tax, that old thing. Yeah, I think some people have to pay tax. Apparently not Warner Brothers.
Not us.
It's not something they even think about. And then depreciation and amortization. I mean, they're a film studio. I think they have a little bit of cost to operate their massive film studios, their physical infrastructure. There might be a little bit of a cost involved in that.
Oh, man. Value of that, all those assets go up. Because then you can say, this is the studio that we filmed Barbie in. And then they're like, oh my God, wow.
Yeah.
We've got to pay a premium to get that studio. Yeah. It's the Barbie studio. Yeah. There's no depreciation.
No. They just repair themselves, those studios. They improve themselves. Yeah. Apparently.
They do. Absolutely. Yeah, you're not wrong.
Yeah, yeah. So it's obviously insane for them to reduce some of these items, especially the interest is just ridiculous.
The interest.
That is just the most insane thing. Like, they've just gone through, like, one of the biggest spin-offs and mergers in the media space.
Yeah.
And they've got an enormous debt pile, only second to Disney, who did the biggest media merger just a few years ago. And to remove interest and say you're profitable is just... Come on, it's kind of a joke.
Come on, mate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The CEO said in a statement, this is a generational disruption we're going through. Going through that with a streaming service that's losing billions of dollars is really difficult to go on the offense. So he actually, I just realized he actually did mention that they are losing billions of dollars in the statement. It's just in the press release, they say that they're profitable. That's actually kind of funny. He's kind of contradicting himself there. The headline of the press release says streaming is profitable for a second straight quarter. It's kind of funny to see that. But yeah, so that statement really says it all. They're going through this kind of decline in classic, their linear business, and at the same time trying to manage the streaming business.
Maybe he was talking about Disney when he said that.
He calculates their problem.
It's a generational disruption we're going through.
Yeah.
And going through that with a streaming service that's losing billions of dollars, it's difficult for them to go on the offense.
Wouldn't want to be
not
him.
Us, though.
Yeah, wouldn't want to be him.
luckily for us, because we're so profitable, we can go on the offense. In fact, because our adjusted EBITDA is $20 trillion, we're actually considering acquiring Disney.
So there you go.
We're in talks with Apple right now of acquiring their business too.
It's so
contradictory, isn't it?
Yeah. I actually didn't even, I just, I copied and pasted that quote, but I just realized just then that he actually says that the streaming service is losing money, and the headline of the press release that he released says streaming is profitable for two straight quarters, which is just a hilarious contradiction. This is crazy. But Luke, no. Profitable and losing billions of dollars are two different things. They can happen at the same time. you can be burning billions of dollars and be profitable. That's Wall Street
just,
for you.
That's just finance 101, Hamish.
Yeah, exactly. Come on.
All right. We need to tone back the sarcasm here. We're going to start losing people.
finally, we'll do Paramount quickly. Paramount revenue was $7 billion for the quarter, up 3% year over year. TV media was down 8%, as expected. Direct-to-consumer was up 38% year over year. So big growth in the direct-to-consumer business, although it's from a base of that it's a $1.7 billion business, so it's kind of small, which makes the high growth expected. Their film business grew 14% year over year to $891 million. Unfortunately, though, the film business was unprofitable. So, they were able to grow business the revenue, but the costs kind of ate into that. On the direct-to-consumer business, they added 2.7 million Paramount Plus subscribers to reach 63 million subscribers in total, but they are still very unprofitable. And unlike Warner, they don't claim to be profitable. They at least admit to that.
They acknowledge.
Yeah, they acknowledge. And that's basically it. Nothing too crazy to talk about with Paramount. So yeah.
Turbulent times in the media industry.
Yes.
Wonder how. The thing that I'm interested in is watching the operating income of Disney Plus. They've said that they want to get this thing profitable in the next couple of years. I just wonder how long that takes. It'll be interesting.
Yeah. So Disney's timeline is they still think they'll be able to get streaming profitable by Q4 2024, is what they're aiming for. But who knows?
So yeah, they got a year.
Yeah. Previously they said the end of 2023, and that got pushed. So. It's still relatively uncertain. Probably depends a lot on the strikes as well. The actor strike continues to go on.
Yeah, true.
Which ironically has been making these businesses look more profitable than they probably are, because everyone's been forced to cut content spend through this year. So it's kind of, ironically, even though they're unprofitable, it's probably going to get worse next year, unless they plan to try and ride out kind of the same lower level of content spend into next year. Hope that consumers are kind of used to the less new stuff that's been coming out throughout this year. It's going to be interesting.
Yes, indeed. All right, Hamish, do you want to just do 2 minutes on the RBA stuff here?
Oh yeah. Very quickly. The new governor of the RBA, Michelle Bullock, made her second rate decision today, raising the official cash rate by 25 basis points to 4.35%, which was it was fairly expected. The market had assumed had a 90% probability that it would happen. But obviously, it's a bit of a shock, I think, to a lot of people who have, we haven't been raising rates since June.
For those that don't know, this is the Australian Central Bank.
Yes, Australian Central Bank. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. People are kind of obviously concerned that this will represent another kind of rate hike cycle. And we don't really know, but in a statement, the governor of the RBA did say inflation is past its peak, but is still too high and is proving more persistent than expected a few months ago. In terms of the banks, NAB and ANZ passed on the full 25 basis point hike. Combank has yet to pass it on as of recording this, but is expected to over the next few days. Westpac passed on 45 basis points. So Westpac just I don't know what's going on with Westpac.
Cop that.
But Westpac is like, you know what, it's really hard, guys. But we're gonna pass on an extra 20 basis points here. So I don't know what's going on at Westpac.
We had no other option.
Yeah, yeah.
Our hands were tied, 45 basis points. Actually, no, scrap that, now it's 50.
Yeah. Mid-press conference, they're like, 45. You know what? Let's make it around 50.
Yeah, 50 sounds better, doesn't it? Yeah, 50.
Yeah, 50. 50 are good.
Jeez.
So yeah, I don't know what's going on at Westpac, but they're passing on more than the rate hikes at this point. So on $500,000 loan, this increase, or the 25 basis point increase, would be an extra $75 per month on repayments, or a total of $1,200 across 13 hikes that have happened since COVID. Wow. So, pretty crazy. Pretty crazy. And that's it. There you go.
That's pretty hectic. All right, that is it. Nice. All right, let's do a couple of Q&A questions and then let's bounce out of here. As always, guys, I think we're almost out of Q&A questions. Which is good. We're clearly just so concise. We're answering things so well during the podcast that there's just no questions being raised.
Yeah.
It's a good reflection on us, Hamish, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. I think we gave great answers last week.
Yeah.
I can't remember what we said.
What were we talking about last week?
I can't remember, but it was not good.
Something about like
not setting goals.
We don't do it. Yeah.
Oh, don't set a goal. Don't.
Anyway, all right. If you wanted to ask us a Q&A question, just head to the most recent YouTube version of the podcast and just drop us a comment, and we'll chuck it in our Google Doc.
Yeah, I'll.
Or you can ask through the Spotify question box.
Yep.
All right. Sure.
I'll ask you this first question. Update on your guys' thoughts on options. Options, yeah. So call options, put options. What are your thoughts on them? Do you use them?
I don't. I love talking to Matt Peterson. He's like the options guy. He knows what he's really cool because he's a value investor, but he uses options to be a value investor. Mainly by selling put option contracts to try and get put the shares of companies that he wants to buy at a certain price. So I think that strategy is really cool, and I would like to go deep and learn more about it. I don't trust myself with executing it right because I just haven't delved into the realm of options before. So I think that options strategy is really cool. He's also doing another options strategy where he is essentially, I have to talk to him about how he does it again, but it's similar. He essentially captures a company's dividend for free, which is a really big hack. And I told him, dude, we need to put this in a course. And he's like, honestly, I don't really want to because I don't want people to know about this. Because he's doing it. He's making so much money. I can't remember exactly the way, but he uses options because obviously he sells options.
Yeah.
And he gets paid for doing that. Then he takes on the shares. He gets paid the dividend. And then he gets paid to offload the shares.
Yeah.
So, yes, there's a drop after it goes ex-dividend, but he still has figured out by applying this rigorously over a lot of different companies that he still comes out healthily on top. So, that kind of stuff I find really interesting.
Yeah.
Gambling with stock options, I have no interest in.
Yeah. That's the thing. I think most options is kind of just speculating. Most people, as far as I'm aware, use options to kind of speculate on short-term events, so trading around earnings, for example, you know, buying call options before an earnings call and hoping that the stock rips after the earnings are released or some announcement is made by the company. And I have no interest in participating in that at all. I mean, we even saw throughout this week, in the last couple of weeks, companies beating earnings expectations and their stock falls, right? Which is like, you know, that just shows, even if you outperform previous expectations, the stock can still fall. So there's, you know, that's not even a company missing expectations and then falling. So, you know, what happens in the short term is super uncertain. And I think if you think that you have any way of predicting what's going to happen, you're kind of kidding yourself. But yeah, it is interesting to hear Matt Peterson's approach to including options as a part of his broader value investing strategy. It is interesting. Not something I personally participate in, but certainly interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. All right, should we do one more, Hamish?
Yeah, let's do one more.
You pick. What one should I ask you?
Let's do this one.
All right, cool. The question is, Hamish, what is a good strategy to scale down your holdings in a stock?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different strategies around this. I don't really have a kind of a scaled down or like a trimming strategy that's involved in my portfolio. I either like owning a large piece of a business or large, you know, relative to my portfolio. I either want to own that or I think it's overvalued or a bad business and I don't want to own it. There's no real scale in between. There's no like, oh, it's getting a bit expensive, so let me trim a little bit, or oh, the management team's slightly worse now, so I, you know, there's a bit more uncertainty, let me trim a bit. It's either I'm fully on board or I'm fully not on board. So I don't really have any kind of trimming or scaling down strategy, but that's certainly kind of a more unique value investing approach. There's tons of other strategies that people use, and trimming is a part of a lot of ways that people invest. Whether it's trimming positions because they get too large of a piece of your portfolio that you're too, you know, you're not comfortable having that much of exposure to a particular company, or something along those lines. So yeah, my answer is I personally don't do anything like that. But yeah, there's certainly a wide variety of approaches people have for this. I don't know. What do you do? Do you have any thoughts on this?
I think I agree with you. The only scaling down strategy that I've implemented, and I haven't done it in a long time, but I have done it once with my investment in Tesla, because it's very volatile, is that once I was sitting on a healthy capital gain, I just took my original investment amount off the table. So that I can't lose.
Yeah.
You know, at that point, I've invested, say, $5,000, and then it's gone up. I've taken out $5,000, so I've got my money back, and now the profit can just do whatever, but I can't lose.
Yeah.
So that's the only scaling down. And honestly, I did that because, you know, you wouldn't do that if your stock goes up 10%, you know?
Yeah.
You put in 10 grand and then you go up 10% and then you take out 10 grand. But because Tesla had gone up like 10x.
Yeah.
So like 5 turned into 50 and then you take 5 out and it goes back down to 45. So it's, it's like that kind of equation where I'm just like, well, sure, it's volatile, but now I can feel a little bit better because the actual money that I put in, I've gotten it back.
Yeah.
So anything from here is a positive.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. But honestly, I haven't done that. I've only done that actually once, now that I think about it, with Tesla.
Yeah. It's kind of unique.
Any other time.
Unique situation.
Yeah, it is a unique.
Yeah. I thought every stock in your portfolio was going up 10x.
Oh, mate. Publicly, yes. Privately, no.
Just between you and me.
Just between you, me, and the audience.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, that's funny. That's funny.
But no, when I go on the news, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Well,
I never have losses in my portfolio. I just have slight softenings in my portfolio.
Yeah. It's just a weak market. It's a weak
my
market.
Portfolio environment has softened slightly.
Downturn in consumer confidence. Something like that.
Yeah. downturn in investor confidence. Yeah. I'm the investor.
And I've lost my confidence.
Yep.
Well, right, with that said, yeah, thanks everyone for joining us. As always, as Brandon said, if you have any questions, head over to the YouTube version of the podcast and leave them as a comment there. Or if you're on Spotify, just scroll up and natively ask your questions in Spotify. We're always welcoming more questions. Thanks, Brandon, for joining me, as always. And also, thank you to Seeking Alpha for sponsoring once again, seekingalpha.me/younginvestors, to try Seeking Alpha free for 7 days and get a $50 off coupon. So go check it out if you haven't already. But with that said, we'll see you guys next week. See you later, guys.
See you guys.